Hello and welcome to another episode of Max Planck Florida's Neurotransmissions Podcast. I'm Joe Schumacher, and today I'm joined by Jeremy Chang.
Hey, Joe.
And Alex Gabrizis. How's it going?
Hey, Joe.
Okay, guys. So today we're going to be talking about this really fundamental problem that animals have in the world, which is that they have to generate sets of behaviors that maximize good outcomes for them and minimize bad outcomes for them. That's the basic idea of how like animals survive in the world. But in neuroscience, people are trying to distill this down into really controlled experiments to understand how animals can learn to accomplish these types of behaviors.
And so what Joe's talking about in neuroscience, we call reinforcement learning. Today, we're going to be looking at reinforcement learning with our speaker through the approach of theoretical neuroscience and different approaches to theoretical neuroscience and questions you can ask.
And we'll also talk a little bit about how theoretical neuroscientists are working alongside experimental neuroscientists. And we'll hear an interesting story about the role of dopamine in reinforcement learning and how sort of these two very different questions came together to come up with a more unified viewpoint of what dopamine is doing during reinforcement learning.
That's right. Yeah. So today's guest is a scientific director at the Max Planck Institute for Biological Cybernetics in Tübingen, Germany. He's a pioneer in the world of computational neuroscience. He wrote the textbook on theoretical neuroscience with Larry Abbott. And he is the 2017 recipient of the Brain Prize for his work on reinforcement learning, along with his colleagues who elucidated the roles of dopamine signaling in generating predictions of error and reward signaling. Dr. Peter Dayan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So you're one of the first opportunities we have to talk to somebody about how the field of theoretical neuroscience has evolved over the course of your career, how you got into this area of research, and also like sort of how you've seen the collaborations between experimentalists and theorists evolve over time. But first, basically, maybe you could just give us some insight into how you got into neuroscience in the beginning. You started off doing your bachelor's degree in math. Where did it go from there?
Yes, I started off, as you say, with doing a bachelor's degree in maths, and already I got very interested in artificial intelligence. And I graduated in 1986, which is just the time of the publication of the very famous PDP book, so Parallel Distributed Processing, written by Rumelhart and McClelland. And that really redefined the way that a lot of people thought about how networks of neurons or networks of fairly simple entities could go about doing processing. And that really was a big challenge to the what were then popular things like semantic networks, or the way that people had were conceiving of AI at the time. So that looked like a really fantastic area to go into. And then for reasons I can't actually even reconstruct myself, I thought I should go to graduate school to go and work in this area. And then I only applied to places in the UK. So in retrospect, I actually had visited previous to that, I'd visited various institutions in America, but just for some reason to think about going there as to do a PhD. But I was very lucky. I went to Edinburgh and my advisor there was David Wilshaw. So Edinburgh actually is one of the early universities which was specializing in AI or had a specialism in AI. In fact, David Wilshaw, my advisor, he himself had been a student in Edinburgh. His advisor was Christopher Longett Higgins. So right at the very early days in AI, already they had some input there. And so David himself was somebody who's really had, he was a physicist originally, and he got interested in neuroscience, did a master's in neuroscience, and then worked a lot on development. So he worked on development in various systems. And then just the time I was there, he had started a collaboration with Richard Morris, thinking about memory, thinking about the hippocampus. So he had been, as a graduate student, he'd worked on something called the Wilshaw Net, which was a early device thinking about how it is that networks of neurons could act as a sort of episodic memory in a particular sort of way. And so he then had some background in that field. So I really learned quite a bit about thinking about how sort of mathematics, physics, and computational principles could potentially be involved in the way you can think about neuroscience. So in Edinburgh, I got very interested. In fact, even when I was interested in AI, when I did some work on that when I was an undergraduate, I was already very interested in essentially sequential decision making. So how is it we make decisions when we don't find out immediately what answer we get or what reward we get or what punishment, something you have to do over a longer period. And so I started reading the psychology literature in Edinburgh. And so, in fact, my thesis had two parts to it. One in which I was interested in memory, worked on synaptic plasticity, basically, or thinking about LTP and LTD, which was a hot topic at the time. And then the other was thinking about reinforcement learning. And I, in 1990, I went to a connectionist model summer school. So it was a time where the field was so small that the people who are sort of the key people in the field, like Terry Sanofsky and Jeff Hinton, in sort of connectionist modeling, they had summer schools to try and sort of create a cadre of people who knew about the field. They could get to mutually educate, because you couldn't do a course in this stuff at the time. And so it was there that I then, for instance, I then spent a month with Andy Botto in Amherst. That was very influential because, of course, he was one of the major figures in reinforcement learning. I met Terry Sanofsky. I then in the end became a postdoc in his lab. So, and I also, and Jeff Hinton is somebody I'd known before because he himself had been a student at Edinburgh. In fact, he was a supervisorial brother of my own supervisor. So it's a small community at the time, and so then I was very lucky to go to this summer school, and through that I then sort of made a bunch of other connections which then allowed me to start on this work. So in terms of your question about how theory links to neuroscience, so of course I saw that in David's work. So he'd built some very influential models of development, like the T-Trader model or the neural activity model, which was thinking about how you could get an organized mapping between like the retina and the tectum in that context. And you could see already some of the power of these sorts of techniques to try and essentially make very crisp hypotheses and crisp questions about what could otherwise be very confusing sources of data. And so that looked like something he really wanted to do. Then the other side of that is psychology. So mathematical psychologists themselves around the 1950s, in fact, around the same time that people were thinking about how control theory could be quantified and could work from an engineering perspective, they also had been a very effective way of building quantitative, crisp characterizations of the psychological data, so the behavioral data that you could see there. And so I was very influenced by that sort of work. And of course, that work itself was also very influential on Rich Sutton. So Rich Sutton, as an undergraduate, he already was thinking about learning rules. Even when he was an undergraduate thesis, he was thinking about learning rules in that were originally to characterize psychological data. And then it was when he then went to work with Andy Botto that they then formulated them in, they looked at the richer set of problems that there could actually be. So in terms of my own career, so at Edinburgh, although so I knew Richard Morris, who was a very major figure in memory research at the time, thinking about the water mazes, you probably know about. It was then when I went to San Diego that then I was much more in the sort of an area where there was just a huge wealth of sort of neuroscience going on. So Terry's lab was a very exciting lab, many huge number of postdocs and students, just a very vibrant community. Francis Crick used to come to tea, and it's there that I started interacting with a number of people, including Reid Montague, who we then did this work on. Dopamine with. And so at the time, I knew some of this work on reinforcement learning. Reid had actually come off being a postdoc with Jerry Adelman, and then in New York. And so we talked a lot about many different things. And so one of the things we were very interested in was this reinforcement learning. And then we came across the data from Wolfram Schultz, which is the data on the activity of dopamine neurons when monkeys were in situations in which they could get reward, or they were predictors of this future reward, their actions they could do. And so it seemed like just the sort of data that one would want to understand by thinking about principles of how systems of any sort could go about optimizing their behavior. And so it was really a chance of being place of being the right place at the right time, really.
So as a field in general, the computational neuroscience world, were people mostly focused on questions at the level of behavior and predicting, how animals do things, like sort of like in the reinforcement learning world? Or is there also at this time a lot of people working on like very basic cellular biophysical modeling? Is it?
Yeah, so the most successful, so I like to think of theoretical neuroscience as having three parts to it, really. So there's data analysis. So that wasn't so big at that time because, you're calling one neuron at a time. Data analysis isn't so bad. These days, data analysis is a huge part of what we all do because you can record gargantuan numbers of neurons. You have to worry about the statistics of it. We have all sorts of models for that. The second thing is what I can think of as mathematical neuroscience. So that's where neuroscience, just like any other natural science, so their modeling is an absolutely critical component of that because you're trying to understand sort of mechanistic and explanatory models. So a great example of that is Hodgkin-Huxley, so the biophysical model of spiking. So they were trying to build a mechanistic model of how spikes get generated, and they appealed to what for them were just descriptive models of gating. So they had this idea about how membranes would do these gates that could let different sorts of charged ions in and out and so forth. And through that, now, of course, now we can go another level deeper and say, well, we understand that these gates actually have a molecular realization that we can then do as you heard Sagamon, right? So you had a lot about single channels through things like patch clamping. So Then the third area of theoretical neuroscience is computational neuroscience, what we can consider to be really computational neuroscience, which is where we're using, because we think the brain is actually solving important, interesting computational problems, we can use the fact that it's doing that to ask a whole range of different questions that you otherwise couldn't ask. So the weather isn't doing anything other than just being the weather. So you use mathematical, the equivalent of mathematical neuroscience to understand the weather. But, you know, there's no point in asking it to do a computation for you. But, you know, the brain has to do computations, it has to survive. So the mathematical neuroscience has a huge, long and rich history where people have been thinking both at the biophysical level, for instance. There's lots of, you know, rich biophysics there, a lot of work on oscillations, a lot of work on dynamics, basically. So how is it that, you know, what's the dynamical properties we expect to get from groups of neurons? And so how oscillations work, how a lot of work, in fact, that Larry Abbott did when he was working also with Eve Mod. So that's macrocystic ganglion, for instance. And then computation neuroscience then is where I became interested. I was particularly interested. And there was probably a little bit less work in those areas. But obviously, a lot of the people who'd been thinking about memory were thinking about it in terms of computation. Now, what is an episodic memory, for instance? So the work of people like Hopfield, for instance. And so they're then trying to link these things together. And then there's a slight gap, if you like, between the sort of the physicist's approach to these things, the computational person's approach to these things, and then the mathematician's approach to these things. And so that sort of remains as through the field. And there's always and this is a complaint that people give for theorists even these days, is to what extent are you building a theory about a real system, and to what extent are you building a theory which is just, you know, a beautiful theory in and of itself. And that's something which is a very hard tightrope to walk, because you obviously want to build theories which are themselves appealing, that they appeal to interesting things. But biology doesn't have, you know, it didn't have any need to generate really simple sort of phenomena. And I think one of the reasons that it's interesting to work in reinforcement learning is that these systems are so mission critical for animals, right? You know, they didn't do a good job of optimizing their rewards and minimizing their punishments, then they wouldn't have lived to tell the tales, and we wouldn't be here to report on that. And so that means that they have a reason that they should be doing a good job and we know what it is to do a good job. You know, we know about what Bayesian decision theory is. We know we have a very precise characterization of what quality is in terms of what you'd like to do in those terms. We also know quite a bit about what's difficult for different sorts of systems for doing it, and it's that clash that we're thinking about. So I think there's a lot of work at the mathematical neuroscience that has gone on and has been extremely revealing. There was perhaps a little bit less work in computational neuroscience, and indeed that was one reason why the PDP books were so influential, because they were taking very clear computational questions and then saying how can they get realized in network terms.
How does that sort of relate to where artificial intelligence was at the time? Because it does seem, if you look back, there are sort of these theories about how to build an artificial intelligence that are very biologically far removed, right? Was the sort of the idea of distributed processing sort of this first genesis towards looking at more biologically inspired artificial intelligence, or was there more, yes, was I there sort of running idea
in
there?
Biologically inspired AI has sort of come up and down in many different ways. So the early days of McCulloch and Pitts, for instance, you know, so I think around the days of Turing, you know, he knew about those sorts of systems. He was interested in learning. He thought about how is it that children should, you know, he thought we should make our computers learn the way that children work. And then, you know, then went through a down phase, and then there were things like perceptrons. Then it went through another up phase, and it went through another down phase, and another up phase. So it goes up and down the whole time. One important issue is that humans don't represent a pinnacle of intelligence, right? There's nothing that says this is the mark of what it is to be intelligent. And if you're not like us, then you're not there. So we all accept that, you know, like computers can do much better than us in some things, like, you know, calculating, you know, doing mathematical calculations or doing many other things. And there's nothing to think that we represent, you know, the peak of anything in particular. Partly because the sort of hardware that we have to do, or the wetware that we have to do these calculations on, of course, has its own properties. You know, we are fantastically good at some things. We embody wonderful evolutionary heuristics, which are, you know, perfectly adapted to the sorts of world that we at least evolved in, maybe not the modern world. But there's nothing to think that we don't think the computers are going to be better than that. So coming back to your question then, so I think that these things have gone up and down in terms of how biologically inspired they are. And of course, there are some people who take that very literally and say, let's try and, you know, recreate neuromorphic hardware. Let's try and just say that there's, you know, we are very good at hugely energy efficient, for instance. So let's try and use that as a way to give us a new metaphor for thinking about the way that some aspects of processing work. So I think that's a really good idea. It's interesting to do, but very hard because, of course, the neural, the components that we have in the brain are just so different from the components we can build out of silicon that it's not always easy to do that. But again, you can often get metaphors and get understanding that way, even if in the end what you build is extremely different. And so then if you look at companies like DeepMind, for instance, the innovations that they're doing, they're nicely walking this tightrope between, on this ridge, essentially, between being truly biological and being biologically inspired. And so then, the nature of what it is to take your inspiration, as we all know as a scientist, we get inspiration from many different things. And so using biological inspiration like that is one nice example.
So I guess this is going back to something you were talking about before. I'm really struck by this idea that you mentioned of there's the mathematics approach to a problem, physicist, computational, and a neuroscientist approach to a problem. And it sounds like you are in an interesting position to have some insight into all of those. And I'm curious if you can give us a sense of what that intersection is like and where those different perspectives might maybe diverge.
Right. So I think of course, some of those perspectives I know much better than the ones I apply myself. I think to say that neuroscientists, I think we can all consider ourselves to be neuroscientists, right? So neuroscience is a broad church. There's an experimentalist approach to it, and there's a theorist approach to it, and there's different sorts of theory. So my wife, who's also a neuroscientist, she likes to say that the best experimentalist is a theorist, and the best theorist is an experimentalist. So try and do that both together, and in one of the fields that she works in, psychophysics, that's quite possible to do, quite easy to do. And to some extent in certain aspects of behavioral research, it's also fairly easy to do. So we can do get subjects to do multi-arm bandits, and we can even put them in an fMRI scanner. These are all parts of neuroscience. Just that, so we shouldn't only think of experimental neuroscience as the only sort of neuroscience there is. So in terms of the questions you ask, again, it comes down to the hypotheses you have and the way that you can ask those you can test those hypotheses in the most clear way. So we all, I think, understand a good experiment is something which cleanly decides between two different ways that something might happen. It's extremely difficult to design those sorts of experiments in many areas. We have so much uncertainty, and there are so many sort of background conditions we don't know the answers to, that then saying this really is a clear test of hypothesis one versus hypothesis two is in many cases almost impossible. But the ways we can try and make it more possible is by trying to help with the degree to which we can quantify aspects of things. And we can then say that we can then turn our hypotheses into something which we can ask as sharp a question as we possibly can. And that's something which I think everybody strives to. What you see is that there are fantastic experimentalists who essentially are qualitative theorists. And then you also have people who are who are trying to build more quantitative theories. And then the interaction between those two has always, I think, has been very, very fruitful. So in my area of research, what I see is that there are particularly in psychology, actually, there are a number of individuals who are purely experimentalists. They're not really building a computational model, but they've asked much crisper theoretical questions than I've ever asked myself in their experiments. And you can see that these experiments then really address precisely. They really capture a question to its joints, which is really a theoretical question, but they've come at it from thinking just in an abstract theoretical way. So it's if you think of the best of philosophy, that instead of can ask very precise questions. And so that's, I think, is where we learned a lot. So there's nothing about being able to put down a bunch of Greek letters on a page which make the questions right or better. It has to be the symbols have to make sense with respect to what the underlying problem is. And I think that you can build that in a qualitative way. It's just easier often to ask and answer those questions in a quantitative way once you have that sort of quantitative theory. Now, in terms of computation versus sort of physicists versus mathematics, I think there's a style as much as anything else as the way that you ask the sorts of questions you think are important and the way you ask those questions. So traditionally, one thinks of physicists as being very willing to make approximations of rather large sorts when they're trying to understand trying to make predictions about the way things work, and they often work very well in systems where you have essentially very large number of elements, and so that works great for things like ideal gases, where you have lots of molecules that are all exactly the same. As you move more into neuroscience, that gets harder. So a lot of the early work in early physics work in neuroscience has depends, or at least relies partly on the idea that we have sort of everything sort of sampled randomly from some nice, you know, convenient sampling distribution that you can then sort of average over in very interesting ways. So order parameters you may have heard of as a sort of physics concept along those lines. So that doesn't work so well from a computational point of view, because, you know, we have, our behavior is contingent, our synapses are contingent on the experiences that we have had and the experience that we have come to have in an environment. So, you know, from reinforcement learning point of view, you know, this synapse is big because it enables this action, which enabled us to get reward in this circumstance. So it's not that you can treat each synapse as being equivalent to any other synapse. They actually have roles in the way the system actually works. And so there, thinking computationally can often be, thinking computationally about what it is these computations do can be very important. And the same reason is why, you know, you have to ask large-scale connectomics questions very carefully, because again, you know, the synapses that we have, you know, the statistical notion of those synapses, interesting though it is, doesn't always reflect the fact that they really capture the contingency that an organism has had with its environment over that time. And that's what really makes it work. That's why this organism has got to survive, at least at the point you did the experiment.
So I'm curious, from the point that you sort of got interested in the field of reinforcement learning to today, I mean, a lot has changed. You've learned a lot of stuff. But like, so in parallel, what was the type of work you were doing early on? You defined the problem as kind of an animal is trying to maximize its rewards, minimize its punishments. I think that's a very concise way to describe it. At the same time, people were working on dopamine signaling and, you know, the role that this was playing. Is this sort of two parallel paths of inquiry that people were working on, or is it a direct collaboration? Were people sort of feeding off of the results from each other as these things were coming together?
No, so these things were, at the time, were extremely separate, right? So if you look at the... So the reason why people like Wolfram, for instance, started recording from dopamine cells actually was nothing to do with their work in reinforcement learning. In fact, it was mostly at that time to do with their work in motor control, right? So Parkinson's disease, famously, you know, dopamine cells are the cells which you can see dying, and that led to a lot of motor problems. And so the tasks that Wolfram was using early on were largely ones that were, I think, originally he expected them to show aspects of how dopamine is involved in motor movement. And so, and although there was also work in brain stimulation reward, which people knew involved somehow the dopamine system, I think they at that time they were not thinking quite in this rather direct way that then you know, Wolfram's experiments and then reveal. On the other hand, on the computational side, you know, people certainly, you know, there's this lovely work from Sutton and Barto thinking about reinforcement learning. They were very motivated by, they were largely motivated by behavioral results, and that which they understood very well. And indeed, this comes back to these behavioral experiments that have been very revealing about how things worked. And they actually, in an early influential paper of theirs in 1981, Sutton and Barto actually made some sort of neural hypotheses, but they didn't involve dopamine. They had other ideas about the way that prediction learning worked. And in fact, that was before they had worked on the temporal difference learning work that then actually came to work afterwards. So then what happened is that, you know, that then is the luck, you know, in a sense. I mean, you know, of course, it's hard to be, you know, it's hard not to be sort of Whiggish about history, but you can see in a sense, you know, so Reid and I were in Terry's lab. We were in a very good position to understand then to put these two things together. What then happened, you know, I'm not saying it's a result of our work, but, you know, what happened subsequently, so temporarily, is that then this whole area of neuroscience exploded in terms of the volume of questions that could be asked and could be answered. And it's partly, I think, because we had this really easy interaction between theorists and experimentalists, you know, working together. So you could ask, you know, these fantastic questions. Also, you know, fMRI was around, and so then we could ask some of these questions in humans, which I think helped a lot. But then also technology advanced in terms of how you could record from dopamine cells or record dopamine or psychic voltammetry, many other different things. And it's an area, so in the computational area, so I really give a lot of credit to Rich Sutton particularly, and also Andy Barto as well, for keeping it a very collegial area. So I see other areas of neuroscience where and maybe computational science too, where people act in a much less sort of, you know, like a collegial way. I think sort of Rich sees himself as, and I think correctly, as, you know, he's the sort of the grand, both the grandfather, the father of reinforcement learning. And so he has worked really hard to make sure that everybody's communicated together. And that's another reason why the field has grown so quickly. And then you add to that, you know, the interest in economists. So like there's this field of neuroeconomics that you know, Paul Glimcher and Reid Montague, a number of people have been closely involved with Colin Camera. Liz Phelps, a number of others as well. And then the psychologists then, you know, have already a lot of the tools they would need to ask these questions. And that then just synergized very nicely with the fact that the issues that the animals are trying to face, as you say, they're these very basic issues that need to have been solved well. And so I think that then became this very fortunate, fertile ground for a lot of this this burgeoning research that happened in the area.
I mean, so I think probably a lot of our listeners have heard of dopamine as a reward signal. How does it fit into this reinforcement learning paradigm?
Great question. So in reinforcement learning, the work that Sutton and Barto did was really most influential. It was this rule called the temporal difference learning rule. And what they started from was understanding something about the nature of prediction. So in psychology, in the late 60s, early 70s, already the psychologists were thinking very much about what it is to build a predictor, essentially. At the same time, how people in engineering were. And so there's this famous rule called the Ruskolo-Wagner rule, which is a prediction learning rule. And the way the prediction learning works is it's as simple as you can imagine. It's just the difference, you calculate the difference between what actually happened and what you expect. And then that difference, if it's positive, it means, you know, you got more than you expected. If it's negative, you got less than you expected, and you can use that to change your weights. So what Rich Sutton and Andy Botto realized is that's not enough to understand the way that learning should work for animals. Because that's a great way of predicting what you have available right at the moment, but that's not very interesting to predict. If you have it there, it's actually there straight away. And they realized that, in fact, when you look at the results in many areas of animal conditioning, you need to have something which is interested in predicting the future, right, which is notoriously difficult. And they said, okay, what we're trying to do is predict not what happens now, but predict some aspect of the things that are going to happen across the future. And in that case, you need to have a different learning rule, and that led to this temporal difference learning rule. So at the same time, Wolfram had been recording from these dopamine cells, and what he had observed is something which they have this very unusual, what looks like a fairly unusual property. So when you provide an unexpected reward to an animal, you get to in this case, he was working on monkeys recording, giving them things like juice or little pieces of apple or things like that. He saw an activity of these dopamine neurons. That's just what you expect. Something unexpected should lead to this. He also saw, though not exactly contemporaneously, that if you didn't give them something they expected, you got a dip, you know, below baseline. That also makes perfect sense. What he saw that didn't make so much sense originally is that when you have a cue now that predicts reward happening later, then you see that the dopamines, after the animal has learned that relationship, then the dopamine cells are activated by the earliest reliable predictor of the reward and not by the reward itself. So that makes much. So the fact that it's not activated at the time of the expected reward makes perfect sense. The fact that you get this cue at the time the cue for this future reward comes on, this reliable cue for future reward, that you get dopamine responding at that time. That's what's unique about the temporal difference learning rule, and it's really central to the way the temporal difference learning rule works. And it was that Wolfram also recorded in the dopamine cells. So dopamine, therefore, by this, looks like it acts like a temporal difference prediction error. Then you can ask, well, what should a temporal difference prediction error do? You know, what's its power? How can it control things? And this TD error, this temporal difference error, should in principle control two different things. One is you should learn to predict the future. The other is it can learn actions. And the way that you think about that is, if something unexpectedly good happens, either it means that you just were terrible at doing predictions, so you should change, you know, you should therefore boost your prediction next time. Or maybe of all the actions you did, you normally do, you don't do a very good job. You did a great action this time that led to the fact that now you're expecting some big reward in the future. And if that happens, you should change which actions you do to prefer the action you did. So this one temporal difference signal has two roles. This is actually reflected in a reinforcement learning rule called the actor critic, where the critic is the system which is about the prediction learning, and the actor is the thing about the active learning. And so it looked like dopamine was both, we could see in the activity that it looked exactly what you expect from this temporal difference prediction error. And then dopamine should have this capacity to change predictions. We knew much less about that, actually. We still know a little bit less about that. But also it should have the capacity to change actions, too. And that then was then fed very nicely into the literature that was known at the time about things like brain stimulation reward, where although there are a lot of debates showing at the time that it's probably not the direct activity of dopamine neurons that is the substrate of the learning in these brain stimulation reward experiments, that dopamine nevertheless has a clear, important role to play. And in fact, I collaborate with Peter Schizgal, you know, who's in Concordia, very interested in understanding exactly what are the limits of the role of dopamine in this brain stimulation reward. Anyhow, so we knew that dopamine should be, was in a good position to be involved in this. We also knew about drugs of addiction. So many drugs, not all, but many drugs of addiction operate through dopamine too. And they, of course, if you can seize control of the mechanism, which is about evaluation and about the way that you can control actions, then that would be one of the most powerful ways you could go about controlling behavior, which is, of course, exactly what drugs of addiction do. So dopamine has both these roles to play, and therefore, and it also has the same property, at least in those early recordings from Wolfram, what it looked like there. So then, in a sense, then the scene was set for a lot of the work then took place.
So can you tell us a little bit about how this relates to what you're working on now with neuromodulation and decision-making, and maybe where you see that going?
Yes. So I spent at least 20 years of my life trying to work on good quality decision making. And so now I work on bad quality decision making, essentially, crudely. So that's to say, you know, we understand now quite a lot about the various different circuits which are involved in good quality decision making. And largely, of course, in the early days, we would do that thinking in general across whole populations, asking what that looks like. So over time, and partly through my links to people like Ray Dolan, one of my collaborators in London, who's actually a psychiatrist, and then also through Reid Montague, who set up actually something called the Computational Psychiatry Unit in Baylor College of Medicine a long, long time ago. Very one of the first people interested in that topic, but obviously he's somebody I've worked with a long time. We got interested in understanding what are the key modes of failure of decision making. So in psychiatry, as you know, a lot of aspects of psychiatry are not only about decisions. Right? It's about feelings, about, you know, many other critical aspects. But a lot of psychiatry is also about that people make decisions that either they or society wish they didn't make. And so if we understand about decision-making, we should understand how it is that it can break. And so if we have the right coordinate system for disease, essentially, could come from thinking about many routes to failure of these decision-making systems. So then once you start to look at problems that way, you start to realize just the very many ways that these systems can be fragile, can be interestingly fragile. Now, of course, the fact that we generally do a good job of surviving in the world means that there are also lots of robustness built into them too. And that's something that always happens in the case of learning. But it's a real encouragement to us to think about the way the system can be wired up in order that you get these fragilities. And one of the sources of fragility is the fact that we are adapted and we've evolved in a different, very different environment from the ones we currently occupy. And indeed, there's a whole sort of field of Darwinian psychiatry, which is also interested in exactly that same question. And then looking at different sorts of psychiatric diseases and saying, okay, well, why would it make sense for a system to be organized in such a way that you see this sort of bad, what looks like, you know, unfortunate decision-making in that time? We can also ask that same question at a more mechanistic level, which is the level of how it is that, you know, decisions actually get made. And so we're now very extremely interested in doing that, looking at a number of different psychiatric phenomena, and then trying to do things like, because as you probably know, there's a lot of questions in psychiatry itself about how predictive are the sorts of questionnaire measures, so self-report measures they have, can they be used to discriminate between different people who will benefit from different drugs? Can they be used to make different prognoses about what's going to happen to individuals? And one of the criticisms of modern psychiatry is it's very hard to do that in a very powerful way. And so one, you know, very extreme hope for this field of computational psychiatry is that it will provide us with other ways of thinking about these sorts of questions, other alternative nosologies, if you like, with which we can then essentially split up the problem in different ways and then make progress in exactly that way. So that's one of the areas that I work in. The second area is neuromodulation as a whole. So as you mentioned, so dopamine is a neuromodulator. So it's involved in somehow regulating excitability and plasticity rather than involved so much in direct transmission. And it's a really fantastic time because there are all these fantastic new tools that have just come out in this field. So ways of measuring dopamine that we could never hope to do before, ways of manipulating it we couldn't hope to do before either. And so lots of questions that we wanted to ask for a long time are now can actually be asked. Also, again, in collaboration with Reid, who's been actually recording using fast scan cyclic voltammetry, which is a particular method for recording dopamine fast fluctuations of dopamine concentration and other neuromodulators too, in human patients during surgery. And so he's done this for actually almost 10 years or so now, where he has a very interesting data looking at dopamine in the striatum. So during deep implantation for Parkinson's disease, for essential tremors and diseases like that. And of course you get informed consent for your subjects and it's explained to them that of course, it's not going to actually help them themselves. But it means that we can then ask a set of questions about these neuromodulators that it's very hard to ask in other ways. And so that's, I think, again, just lots of new techniques with which we can ask ask questions that we've wanted to ask for a long time. So that's very exciting. And then the third area I work in, again, reflecting the fact that many of the bases of decision-making are now becoming, they're now sort of coming a little bit more into focus than they did before because of all the work by many people in the community. So then the next set of questions that come up are the ways that we control the controllers. So if you think of reinforcement learning, that's about the way you make decisions. But inside the way you do reinforcement learning, say, well, how is it you go about doing planning, for instance? So if you think about playing a game of chess, for instance, you have a very complicated planning problem where you might think, I have to think a number of stages ahead, and then I have to think what my opponent might do. But you have to solve a lot of interesting problems. Whereabouts in the board are you going to think about? Where are you going to choose to start your search from? How many levels do you go down thinking about that? How can you manage the fact that you only have a limited amount of working memory? So you can only store a certain number of things so you go and do these sorts of procedures. And so those mechanisms are essentially a set of internal controls. And the way that we and a lot of other people think about it is that essentially it's instead of doing reinforcement learning where the actions you take are actions in the outside world, you lift up something, go somewhere in the world, navigate or whatever. These are actions inside the head. So deploy working memory this way, use attention in the following way. So restrict the way that you control some aspect of the way the brain is actually working. So these sorts of meta control issues, which then also quite closely related to things like metacognition. So you can think of the way that we get to be confident in the decisions we make. These are again, another frontier of work, which then we and others are also very interested in.
So we're actually about at the end of our time here. I'm curious about your involvement in the International Brain Laboratory. So this is a really impressive, amazing project that's going on. My understanding is that we have this fundamental problem of behavioral assays in decision making not being super standardized across laboratories, and this is a big undertaking between lots of experimentalists and computationalists. Where are you fitting in on this project, and how are the roles of the different laboratories sort of being parceled out in this massive project?
Yes. So the IBL, so the International Brain Lab, indeed is a project. It was started by Alex Puget, Zach Main, and Mike Hauser. And then they recruited essentially a bunch, started off with, of course, their friends, and then expanded a little bit beyond that. So now we have 21 labs, 11 experimental and 10 theoretical labs. So it's partly, in a way, a response to the Human Brain Project, which I think a lot of people were very upset about and very unhappy with, as probably many of you know. But on the other hand, one thing the Human Brain Project got right is the idea that we need to do neuroscience at a different scale. And then, as you mentioned, one trouble with that is that we have lots of labs doing somewhat similar behavioral tasks with mice, for instance, or with other model systems. But the tasks are not so precisely similar. You can actually integrate information from them jointly. And also, they're not so precisely similar that the theories you might build for one would exactly be the right for the other. So what Mike, Alex, and Zach saw is a great opportunity to say, well, why don't we all agree, since we can all agree to do one decision-making problem, at least to start off with, then we can more easily record from everywhere in the brain during that decision-making problem. We can easily recruit theorists to get interested in understanding some aspects of how that decision-making works. So the project has gone, as you imagine, getting herding the cats has been an interesting task over this time. And so the project is, I think, is going extremely well considering the challenges that it has. And we're very grateful, of course, to the Simons Foundation and the Wellcome Trust for funding us for doing this. So I'm one of the theoretical labs there. And so what's happened is there's again, one of the other aspects of the way they're trying to do science in a new way is to how the way that we make decisions as a consortium, decision-making itself, we should be at least thinking about how way we can make decisions as a consortium. And things like, how is it that the people we assign jobs or we collect jobs ourselves in terms of the things that need to be doing in terms of the data. So we're just at the stage now where we're starting to get large-scale neural recordings. We spent a long time sort of making the behavior so it was replicable in 10 different labs or so that are actually doing it. And so now we're a very exciting time. We have this neural data coming out. So my own interested, I mean, of course, like many of the other theorists, I'm interested in many different questions we can ask in this decision. It's a simple decision-making task in mice, pretty much, to start off with. So one thing I have a student, Sebastian Bruins, who's doing, is to try and build a model, essentially, which characterizes the entire way that in this case, a mouse might come to solve this particular task. So often we think when we're building models, we imagine this pretty much the asymptotic state. We say, okay, well, here's an animal which sort of knows pretty much everything about the task, knows that it shouldn't pay attention to the odd whirring noises of the fan in the lab, but instead is just paying attention to, you know, light one versus light two and reward one versus reward two. That's not an accurate description of how animals come into they don't come born knowing that this is what they should pay attention to, even though that's what the experimenter would like. So we're very interested in what's the process by which they come to understand the structure of the task we're posing to them, and how might that influence the sort of learning curves that we see in the animals over time. So I have a student, Sebastian, looking at that. But of course, the consortium as a whole, we got this neural data. So lots of people like Jonathan Pillow is involved. So very interested in Liam Paninsky, very interested in many aspects of neural data analysis. So I think, you know, we're not at the stage we can say it's a success in the sense that we have reliable behavior in many different labs for a mouse, which is that itself is, you know, although it seems trivial, actually it was not trivial to achieve. And I think it's a major achievement of the project itself. And then we have, you know, we're planning 600 odd penetrations using NeuroPixels probes, using the silicon probes, and so then we're just about to get this deluge of data. So we're nervous and excited in equal measure.
Exciting times.
Absolutely.
Well, I would encourage our listeners to go check out. I think the first preprint on the behavioral side of things just came out recently.
It's 300 pages of appendices on exactly how you can troubleshoot the task.
Yeah, and there's like something like 3 million mouse choices encapsulated in the paper. Dr. Dan, thank you so much for joining us today. This is great.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Okay, so that's our show. Thank you so much to Dr. Peter Dayan for joining us today. It was a really illuminating conversation. What did you guys think was, you know, particularly striking about what we talked about today?
Yeah, I feel like I learned a lot. He covered lots of aspects from, you know, like receptors all the way to clinical psychiatry and everything in between and all the different approaches and ways of thinking about that I don't think there's usually that much breadth.
I mean, it seemed like, you know, we didn't get into it, but what he was hinting at with the computational psychiatry stuff was like, a lot of his work now is sort of teasing apart how individual differences might play out in some of these modeled systems that he's working with. And, you know, a lot of psychiatric disorders present themselves in very variable ways. So are there ways to like diagnose individuals to get to the root of their problem that, you know, are sensitive to some of the individual differences in human behavior? Like, it'd be really interesting if, you know, going beyond like the sort of diagnostic that clinicians would typically do now, you could give them a behavioral task and be like, oh, you have version B of disease A or whatever.
And we typically think of diagnostic as like, I'm going to do a test that checks for like whether you have this molecule or whether you have a defect in of brain formation or something, right?
And yeah, or you fill out a survey where you like rate 1 to 5 like a list of symptoms, and then they say yes, you have ADHD or something like that. So I mean, it seems like the future is bright for this type of work. We could have gotten into a little bit more of this. He mentioned the company DeepMind, but a lot of this computational approaches to neuroscience are really big in industry now. So like, you know, this is maybe something we can look for going forward, is understanding like what is it about the tech industry that is benefiting from our brain power in academia. And, you know, I mean, he took a year-long sabbatical at Uber, and I bet he learned a lot about how that type of organization works and that type of work structure works. So it'd be interesting to know, you know, how that plays out in his role as a scientific director at a Max Planck Institute, you know. Be sure to tune in next time. Go ahead and find us on the various social medias. You can listen to us on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, etc.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to Neurotransmissions. You can find us on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, and now on Spotify. Connect with us on Twitter @neuropodcast and at facebook.com/neuropodcast. This has been a production of the Max Planck Florida Institute for Neuroscience.
Bye.
Bye. Awesome.
No.